Welcome to Season 2, Episode 2 of History Stories for My Son, the podcast where we remember that history is a story that should be shared with every generation. As I noted last episode, I recently wrote a book, History Stories for Everyone, and I think if you're a fan of this podcast, you're probably going to like the book too. You can find a link to it on my website, historystoriesformysun.com, and also directly on Amazon under the name History Stories for Everyone and my name, David Faith, the author. It's available both in ebook and paperback, and it would be a great way to support the show. So if you could find it in your heart to take a look at that and leave a 5-star review, you would have my eternal gratitude. This week, we are going to be continuing with a story that was so big it had to be broken into two parts. The story of George Washington. Where we left off, the Revolutionary War had just begun when the Continental Congress of the American colonies convened in Philadelphia to consider how to respond to British aggression. Selecting a commander for the Continental Army was one of its least contentious decisions. Washington, with his frontier fighting experience and knowledge gained from years working with the British Army, was the obvious choice. After 17 years out of uniform, Washington found himself commander-in-chief of all of the armed forces of the 13 colonies. And these armed forces consisted of men who were, for the most part, untrained, undisciplined, untested, and poorly equipped. They were also not particularly numerous, a problem compounded by very short-term enlistments that resulted in soldiers leaving the army almost as soon as they were trained. As of January of 1776, the Continental Army consisted of only 9,600 half-trained men, mostly armed with whatever personal muskets they brought to the army with them. Meanwhile, the British were busy shipping over 30,000 highly trained professional soldiers to the colonies to crush the rebellion. These soldiers were equipped with the best military armaments and supported by the greatest navy in human history up to that time. If you'd been an objective observer at the time, you would not have fancied the colonists' chances. Washington himself was well aware of the odds, yet it doesn't seem he ever considered not accepting the commission. Fortunately, training undisciplined recruits was a task he was familiar with from his days with the Virginia militia. He immediately instituted a regimen of strict discipline and regular drills, conducted even as the army was preparing for an imminent assault on Boston. He quickly removed incompetent officers and instituted a system to identify the skills of soldiers in the ranks and to promote on merit. On March 9th, 1776, in the dead of night, Washington's men pulled off a feat of sneaking cannons up a hill overlooking Boston Harbor without the British noticing until it was too late. The British occupiers awoke to find those cannons raining fire down upon the British fleet in the harbor, which, because of the colonists' elevated position, could not be effectively countered from the water. The British hectically withdrew over the next several days, handing Washington his first major victory and bursting the British reputation for invincibility right at the offset of the war. The next major battles did not go as well. Everyone knew the Brits were likely to occupy New York City because of its economic importance and strategic position on the Hudson River. Washington, who, through heroic recruitment efforts, had more than doubled his army to 23,000, moved quickly to set up defensive positions in and around the city. It was not enough. There was no easily exploitable geographic advantage this time around, no midnight trick to win the battle all at once. It would be a comparatively straight-up fight, with 32,000 excellent British regulars and Hessian mercenaries against the outnumbered and half-trained Americans. The Continental Army lost, and they lost badly. Overcome by superior discipline and marksmanship of their professional enemies. In August of 1776, over a series of battles in and around New York City, the Continental Army was nearly eradicated. About the only good thing you can say about it is that Washington knew when to retreat, and under the cover of heavy fog, successfully escaped to New Jersey with the core of his army, albeit reduced to about 5,400 intact. The British commander, unwisely, chose not to pursue the fleeing colonists, instead hunkering down to set up winter quarters in New York. Washington was able to complete his withdrawal to Pennsylvania, where he began the arduous task of rebuilding his badly mauled army even as winter was coming. It rather understates the matter to say things looked bad as winter set in late 1776. The army's morale had taken a huge hit from the defeats in New York. Desertion rates were high, despite severe penalties, including executions for repeat offenders. The men didn't have enough food or enough clothes. The winter was unusually cold, cruel, bitter. Often soldiers who shared a tent would share a single set of warm clothes with the one man stripping down at the end of his shift while the other donned the same clothes as he set out into the cold. Would have been the easiest thing to quit. Any sense that this was some sort of grand adventure was over. This was not fun. Anyone in it for themselves would have seen very few prospects for advancement in this losing army. It was just hard work in the worst conditions, knowing you were probably fighting for a lost cause. The stress, the pressure, must have been almost unimaginable. Most people would quit under these circumstances, and some did, hence the deserters. Washington never quit. Moreover, through the force of his personality, he somehow persuaded enough of his men not to quit that the army stayed intact. But he needed a victory. The men needed a victory. He spotted an opportunity at Trenton, where the British had encamped their Hessian mercenaries to hold eastern New Jersey against the Patriots. Washington spies had observed that the garrison there seemed lax and complacent. Washington conceived a plan to cross the Delaware River on Christmas, December 25th, 1776, when the Hessians were likely to be distracted by party and drink, and then attack on the morning of the 26th. Never one to ask his men to take a risk he wasn't willing to take himself, Washington personally led the evening crossing. It must have been deja vu, crossing a half-frozen river, watching for errant chunks of ice. The conditions could not have been much worse amidst a snowstorm that blew like a hurricane, and in the darkness. He must have wondered whether he'd be taking another dip in ice water that evening. Only this time it was even worse, because he was worried not only about drowning, but about being spotted by Hessian sentries. The snow helped on that front, at least. Washington reached the opposite shore without incident, among the first of the Patriot soldiers to do so. He personally scouted out the Jersey shoreline, risking capture if any Hessian had been there, and established a perimeter as the rest of the men struggled over. The password was victory or death. The crossing of the army took hours. Every man who crossed risked death. Most did not know how to swim. The heavy artillery was the hardest part. As you can imagine, floating heavy pieces of metal across a blustery, half-frozen river was a recipe for disaster. Incredibly, the men all made it across, with only a handful having taken a dunk before being pulled back by their comrades. By 4 a.m., the army was ready to march. There was only one problem. Washington had split his army into three units, one led by him personally, and two led by subordinate commanders. The other units had fared less well, with ice jams and bad weather largely thwarting their attempts to cross. As the morning of December 26th dawned, Washington had a decision to make. Should he press his assault with only 2,400 troops? Should he wait longer for reinforcements? Or should he pack it in and cross back over to Pennsylvania? Washington decided he could wait no longer, and that going back was not an option. He ordered his men forward. The men, many with rags for shoes, marched through the sleet and snow. They left bloody footsteps in the snow. As they approached Trenton, Washington kept his speech short and simple. "Soldiers, keep by your officers. For God's sake, keep by your officers." He split the men into two different columns. One would attack along the river road to the south, while the other, led by Washington personally, would swing around inland to attack from the north. The surprise was total, with the hungover Hessians not realizing they were under attack until they heard the boom of Patriot artillery. The victory happened so fast that the vast majority of the mercenaries never even managed to take up their weapons. Only a few dozen Hessians were actually killed, the rest, more than 1,000 strong, with all their muskets, powder, and artillery, were captured before they could even put up a fight. On the Patriot side, incredibly, only 3 were killed in action. Unlike his British counterparts, Washington understood the importance of following up on victory. Rather than resting on his laurels, he organized several more crossings of the Delaware and launched another surprise attack, this time at Princeton, on January 3, 1777. There he personally led his men into battle, riding between 2 lines to coordinate musket fire. At one point he was directly between the 2 lines, Patriot and British, as both fired. Observers thought Washington would surely die, but when the smoke cleared, emerging like a figure from legend, Washington stood astride his steed, unharmed, waving the men forward to victory. Washington also understood when to withdraw. Before a much larger British army led by General Cornwallis could surround him, he withdrew from the Princeton area and set up a new winter camp for the army at Morristown. The British did not pursue the buoyant but exhausted colonials, and instead largely abandoned New Jersey as they settled into their winter quarters in New York and New Brunswick. The effect of these Patriot victories was entirely disproportionate to their objective military significance. The Continental Army, which had looked on the verge of defeat just a few weeks earlier, now looked like a winner. Recruitment surged. Colonial leaders, some of whom had been quietly contemplating how to negotiate their own surrender, now had renewed faith in the Patriot cause. For the first time, real, unconditional independence looked like an achievable goal. Meanwhile, in Britain, any hope for a short and painless victory was dashed. The rest of 1777 did not go as well for Washington. The British commander, General Howe, finally moved on Philadelphia, the nation's capital at the time, which forced Washington into European-style pitched battles that the British were simply better trained and equipped to fight. The Continental Army lost. Philadelphia fell. Meanwhile, in upstate New York, Washington's subordinate generals Horatio Gates and Benedict Arnold successfully repulsed a British incursion from the north. Washington fully supported his subordinates in the campaign, which was crucial to avoid having New England cut off from the rest of the colonies, even dispatching critical reinforcements, which weakened his forces in Pennsylvania. However, the simultaneous crushing defeat of Washington at Philadelphia and the victory of Gates up north opened the door for calls to replace Washington as commander-in-chief. Washington understood this quite well, and he dispatched the reinforcements to Gates anyways. Fortunately, Washington's supporters won the argument, and he was allowed to pursue his strategy of keeping the army intact and fighting even while the British occupied the nation's capital. Washington was coming to the realization that the path to victory lay in small, opportunistic attacks to harass the British until they withdrew, rather than sacrificing large numbers of men to hold towns that would be of little strategic value to the British. Still, the winter of 1777 to 1778 was a low point. Washington's army shivered at Valley Forge, something like 2,000 to 3,000 literally freezing to death while the British were comfortably ensconced in Philadelphia. But the army that emerged in spring was harder, better disciplined, having been drilled incessantly in the intervening months. 1778 through 1780 followed a similar pattern. Bitter winters followed by lots of relatively small skirmishes, with the Patriots largely avoiding big stand-up battles. Washington kept his army intact, opportunistically stinging the British and then melting away when the British occupied towns. Washington's key strategic insight was that it didn't matter how many towns the British occupied. So long as the Continental Army existed, the British could never declare victory. Eventually, the British realized this as well, evacuating Philadelphia in the summer of 1778 and largely abandoning their attempts to occupy territory outside of their strongholds. General Howe resigned to be replaced by another British commander, General Clinton. But Clinton didn't fare any better responding to Washington's maddening refusal to line up his entire army in a field to duel it out with the British. That's not to say Clinton didn't try. He was more active than Howe, notably detaching a large body of troops to the American South, hoping to divide and divert the Patriot defenses which had been concentrated in the Northeast. He also resorted to espionage, working through his spymaster to subvert the American general Benedict Arnold. Yet Washington had his own spies, having prioritized building a network of informants behind enemy lines. Arnold's treachery was detected in time to stop him surrendering West Point, a key strategic fort on the Hudson River, but not before the man himself escaped to British-occupied New York. This betrayal deeply wounded Washington, who had respected Arnold for his battlefield bravery and stood by him when others warned of the man's disloyalty and selfishness. Washington was generally a good judge of character, surrounding himself with talented and loyal officers like Alexander Hamilton. But Arnold had been his blind spot. Washington could not have helped but reflect on the irony that the same British army that denied him a regular commission after years of dedicated and honest service rewarded Arnold for his treachery with a brigadier general's commission. By 1781, reinforced by a French expeditionary force who the King of France had dispatched to aid the colonists against his British enemies, Washington finally saw an opportunity for a decisive battle he could win. With British forces split between the army under Clinton in New York and a force under General Cornwallis at Yorktown, it was possible the Patriots and French could achieve local superiority in men and firepower. The key was preventing the British from concentrating their forces in one place. Washington ordered a deception campaign, giving every indication he was planning to lead his forces to attack Manhattan. Indeed, for a time he was actually considering that. But after feinting towards Manhattan and keeping the bulk of General Clinton's forces locked down in New York, he suddenly turned his army around and instead marched the combined Franco-American force of more than 16,000 men to surround the 8,000 Brits under General Cornwallis at Yorktown. While the French Navy prevented British resupply from sea, Washington's men surrounded the city and dug a series of trenches from which to bombard the city before launching infantry attacks that drove the British further and further into their own defenses as each circle of trenches was built closer, like a tightening noose. Finally, on October 19, 1781, Cornwallis recognized that his position was untenable, and he did the unthinkable. He surrendered. Washington's army took more than 8,000 British prisoners, along with all of their artillery and supplies. It was by far the largest Patriot victory of the entire Revolutionary War, and the greatest defeat of British arms in a long, long time. This was the beginning of the end. Although the British Empire certainly had the resources, the money, the manpower to keep fighting if they'd wanted to. Their army's defeat at Yorktown put the exclamation point on what had been apparent for some time. This war, which had been going on for 6 years, was too expensive for what the American colonies were worth. It was time to cut their losses and move on. It took another 2 years to negotiate a peace, but in 1783, the Treaty of Paris was signed. It ended the Revolutionary War and recognized a new nation, the United States of America. George Washington was the man of the hour, the toast of his newly created country. Everybody recognized that it was he who'd kept the army together through all those hard, difficult years. American independence was his achievement as much as it was anybody's. He was greeted with parades and feasts everywhere he went. Many foreign observers expected that, like Caesar, the commander of the conquering army would declare himself emperor. Indeed, some among the patriots thought he should be king, as constitutional monarchy was the only model of relatively liberal government in the world at the time. Washington had other ideas. He had been away from home for 8.5 years. He'd done his duty. He just wanted to go home to Mount Vernon and live out the rest of his days as a private family man. In December of 1783, he resigned his commission, giving up his position as the most powerful man in America, and gave a statement to Congress that sounds like a valedictory speech of a man committing his last public act. "I consider it an indispensable duty to close this last solemn act of my official life by commending the interests of our dearest country to the protection of Almighty God and those who have the superintendence of them in his holy keeping." He meant it. He spent the next 3 years focused on private affairs, in large part because it was financially necessary to do so. Washington had refused pay for serving as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, and his estates had not run a profit in his absence. Washington divided his time between family, business, and receiving the constant stream of well-wishers who he was too polite to turn away. He did nothing to suggest he intended to return to public affairs. Then, in 1786, a group of patriots approached him about attending a constitutional convention to be held the following year in Philadelphia. They argued that the Articles of Confederation were too weak to hold the country together, and that a new constitution creating a more powerful federal government was necessary for America to function as a country. Washington understood their arguments, having 3 years earlier described the Articles as a rope of sand. Washington initially refused, but finally acquiesced when they argued that other states would be more likely to support the endeavor and send delegates if Washington, who everyone respected, was there. So it was that in May of 1787, Washington was dragged, quite unwillingly, back into public affairs. To make matters worse, Ben Franklin nominated him to be president of the convention, and he was overwhelmingly elected to the post. Despite that, Washington was one of the least vocal attendees of the convention, determined not to dominate the proceedings. He did, however, quietly lend his prestige and support to the so-called Virginia Plan to draft a new constitution altogether, rather than merely revising the Articles of Confederation, as had been the original purpose of the convention. The Virginia Plan won out, and the document now known as the Constitution of the United States of America was the result. Washington then quietly lobbied for ratification of the new constitution, which was duly adopted. That left just one little thing to do. Per the terms of the new constitution, the executive branch of the new government would need a leader. A new office was being created, the office of President of the United States, and there would have to be an election to fill that office. It was an election like no other in American history. Washington did not campaign, and in fact, let it be known, he'd really rather not have the job, but if the delegates chose him, he would accede to their wishes. It was not close. A majority of every single state's electors went for George Washington. The votes were tallied on April 6, 1789, and the congressional secretary was dispatched to Mount Vernon to inform Washington he'd been elected president. Far from thrilled, Washington felt anxious and painful sensations when he heard the news. Nevertheless, he was nothing if not a dutiful soldier, and on April 16th, he set off for New York City, which was temporarily the nation's capital at the time, to be inaugurated. His anxiety is understandable. He was being asked not only to be president, but to define what it meant to be president. He was keenly aware that everything he did would set a precedent, and that if he failed, he would not only be failing himself, but failing his country, and undermining everything his army had fought and died for. No pressure, right? Washington had three major goals. To establish the president as a temporary servant of the people, not as a quasi-king. To establish a federal government strong enough to govern, and to keep partisanship out of the presidency. Two out of three ain't bad. When it comes to keeping the presidency in its proper place, Washington understood that symbolism was important. He'd been mortified by the royal reception he'd received at every stop on the way to his inauguration, where he'd been feted with parades and pomp, feasts and lavish displays everywhere he went. Washington worked hard to avoid similar scenes for the rest of his presidency. He was quick to reject exalted titles proposed by the Senate like His Excellency or His Highness, going instead by the workmen like Mr. President. He often made a point of showing up first at meetings to avoid a deferential scene of everyone rising as he was announced. He tried to refuse a salary, to drive home the point that the president should not personally benefit from his office, but relented when it was pointed out that this would establish a precedent that not all prospective presidents could afford. He respected the roles of Congress and the Supreme Court as equal branches of government and took seriously the limits on his power set forth in the Constitution. Others in his position might have been tempted to rule by executive decree, but he took seriously the fact that the Constitution gave legislative power to Congress and judicial power to the courts. If he wanted legislation, he went to Congress for authority. He appointed the entirety of the first Supreme Court and filled it with strong, independent jurists and kept out of the way as they did their job. Even in the executive branch, Washington didn't want to be the only voice in the room. There's a famous book about Lincoln called Team of Rivals because Lincoln stocked his cabinet with an ideologically diverse cast of characters who he encouraged to argue out the major issues of the day. Lincoln got the idea from Washington, who established the first cabinet, an institution, by the way, that's not spelled out anywhere in the Constitution and which exists really solely because Washington felt he should have a close group of advisors to bounce his ideas off of. What's more, he thought those advisors should have minds of their own, and they should challenge him and each other. He famously appointed two of the most brilliant advocates of two very different visions for the government. Alexander Hamilton, Washington's Secretary of the Treasury, advocated a strong, centralized government that would take an active role in promoting commerce. Jefferson, Washington's Secretary of State, wanted a more decentralized government, with the federal government limited to essentially national functions, like foreign affairs. It's a testament to Washington's prestige and force of personality that he managed to secure the services of both. But in the end, Washington agreed more with Hamilton. After all, establishing a strong central government that could actually govern had been one of his major goals as president, and the reason he had supported the Constitution of the United States. He backed Hamilton's plans to consolidate the former colony's debts, established a national bank, and promoted credit. Unfortunately, it proved impossible to both support a strong government and prevent partisanship. Remember I said two out of three ain't bad? The third major goal, the one Washington couldn't achieve, was preventing the onset of partisanship in the new government. Jefferson, frustrated by Washington's siding with Hamilton, resigned before the end of Washington's first term. And he formed the core of the first opposition party in America. Hamilton, meanwhile, was the de facto leader of the party supporting the president, even though Washington himself never claimed a party. Jefferson's party was called the Democratic Republican, Hamilton's the Federalists. Washington remained nonpartisan and vociferously opposed the idea and the necessity of parties, which he thought encouraged a spirit of division and a faction and distracted people from the unifying goal of doing what was right for the country. But even George Washington couldn't stop humans from being tribal. Washington did not enjoy his time as president very much. And indeed, he took a lot of convincing to run for a second term, doing it only because it was necessary to ensure the precedents he was setting would stick. He refused all entreaties to run for a third term, and in that stroke established the single most important precedent for ensuring the president would not become king. Only one president, Franklin Roosevelt, would break the tradition of running for only two terms. The norm was so well respected that Congress responded to Roosevelt's unprecedented four terms in office by passing a constitutional amendment that was quickly ratified by the states. No other president will ever exceed the limit Washington set. Washington didn't live long after he left office in 1897, dying a little over 2 years later from a combination of a bad respiratory infection and the medical quackery of the time, consisting mostly of slicing open the veins of sick people and draining huge quantities of their blood. In considering Washington's legacy, the greatest may be his radical humility. This was a man who had every reason to be very full of himself. And it's not as though he didn't, as a young man, show the usual tendencies of young men to seek glory and recognition. Recall his anger at Britain's refusal to recognize his service with a royal commission. But it was almost as if the more power and recognition he obtained, the less he needed or wanted to. He really believed in the revolutionary ideal. He must have. There's no other explanation for a man consciously limiting his own power and the power of his office. He wanted the United States to be a republic, and wanted it badly enough that he discarded the chance to be king and founder of a new American dynasty. It would have been so easy to rationalize taking power, laid like a serpent's apple at his feet. He could have told himself being king, or the equivalent under a different name, was the only way to safeguard the liberties of the people. He could have used Caesar's justification that temporary dictatorship was needed just until he could set things on the right path. Very few humans could have resisted that much power that easily at hand. Napoleon, a few decades later, acknowledged that it was wished that I might become a Washington, but he couldn't be. He couldn't resist the power. Few could. Washington's greatest gift may have been to recognize in himself something that many of his future countrymen, in their eagerness to venerate him, forgot. He was far from perfect, and he knew it better than anyone. That's why I think he recognized that he couldn't be king, that no one should be king. That, more than anything, his humility, is what made him the indispensable man.